other clips with a shaven head and dressed in gray robes. He gives his name, hometown, and other personal details in the video before saying he is a prisoner of war of the Taliban. Private Vergdahl also attacks U.S. leaders for their treatment of Muslims in Iraq and Afghanistan, warning the U.S. is no match for the Taliban.
That report from Imtiaz Tayyab. The authorities in northwestern Pakistan say suspected Islamist militants have blown up two boys' high schools. There were no casualties as the buildings were empty at the time. Hundreds of schools in northwest frontier province have been targeted by Islamist militants in recent years. The official weather agency in Japan is to stop giving forecasts for the start of the cherry blossom season, one of the country's most enduring annual rituals. Many towns and businesses plan parties for the cherry blossom season, and forecasters have been made to apologise in the past for getting the dates wrong. And that's the latest BBC News.
You're listening to World Briefing from the BBC with me, Frederick Dove. Despite being physically attacked at midnight mass, Pope Benedict has given his traditional Christmas Day blessing to crowds gathered in the Vatican's St. Peter's Square. Just hours after he was grabbed and pulled to the ground by a woman during a public procession, the Pope today was greeted by a fanfare and children chanting as he appeared on a balcony overlooking the square. Pope went on to deliver an address in which he urged wealthy nations to show compassion towards refugees before switching from Italian to other languages, including English, to remind his audience what he believes is the true meaning of Christmas Day.
May the birth of the Prince of Peace remind the world where its true happiness lies. May your hearts be filled with hope and joy, for the Saviour has been born for us.
Despite Christmas Day proceeding as planned, Christmas Eve did not, with the Pope being pushed to the ground as he was entering St. Peter's Basilica for midnight Christmas Mass. A woman had leapt out of the crowd, and in a video of the incident, she can be seen grabbing the Pope, who then falls forward. The 82-year-old pontiff was helped up and continued with the Mass. Afterwards, these members of the congregation described what they'd seen.
All of a sudden, this person sort of flew over the barricade, and the Holy Father went down, and all of a sudden, all the security people were all on top of it, you know, the whole pile there, getting her off and pulling him back up.
Young lady jumped over the barrier and seemed to have been pulled away. And at that point, she kind of lunged her arms out and grabbed onto the Pope. And that's when they all went down together.
Earlier, my colleague Claire Balderson asked our Rome correspondent David Willey what the Pope had been saying to the crowds listening outside St. Peter's today.
The Pope referred to the small Christian community in Iraq. He showed compassion for them and said that they are under severe stress. He also talked about the problems of minorities in other countries who have to leave their homes for various reasons, whether it's political intolerance or hunger or for any other reason. He wanted to show the relevance of the Christian message to the problems that many people face today, not only in the developing world, but also in the wealthier countries. He said that the church doesn't discriminate in its message to the rich or to the poor.
Was there any indication of how he is following that assault last night?
He appeared a little unsteady on his feet as he came out onto the balcony of St. Peter's, facing the crowd in St. Peter's Square. He spoke, however, I thought, with a fairly firm voice, and he seems really to be none the worse for wear. He is a bit frail at the age of 82, and the Vatican is doing its best to play down, I think, the seriousness of this rather difficult breach of security which took place. just after 10 o'clock last night as the Pope was entering the Basilica and walking in procession with his senior aides and cardinals down the length of the nave. Only just reached the door when this woman lunged at him.
And some more details are emerging now, aren't they, about who she was?
Her name's Susanna Maiolo. She is of dual Swiss and Italian nationality. She's 25 years old and she's at present under psychiatric assessment in a Rome hospital. It's not certain whether she'll be charged with any offence.
Is it perhaps, though, rather surprising that she could get so close to actually assault the pontiff?
Not really, when you consider that the Pope processes during religious ceremonies in close proximity to crowds who gather wherever he goes. Obviously, the Vatican security people are very aware of the dangers to his person, and they're mindful also of previous attempts made against, particularly against his predecessor, when he was shot in St. Peter's Square as he was going round in his Popemobile, John Paul II. But also, there have been one or two minor events during this papacy in which people have tried to leap out of the crowd. But normally, the security people are very vigilant. What is strange is that this woman appears to have been her second attempt to attack the Pope, the first being exactly 1 year ago when she was actually filmed trying to get over the security barrier. But on that occasion, she was successfully restrained by the Vatican police.
And that was David Willey in Rome. The Taliban in Afghanistan have released a video which shows a US soldier who disappeared almost 6 months ago in Paktika province in the east of the country. Ambarasan Etirajan reports.
The video shows a man wearing sunglasses and a US military-style helmet and uniform. He appears healthy and speaks calmly and clearly. In the video, he gives details about himself and his family before criticizing the United States over the war in Afghanistan and its relations with Muslims. He also says the conflict in Afghanistan is going to be the next Vietnam for the United States unless the American people, in his words, stop all this nonsense. A Taliban spokesman then calls for the release of Taliban prisoners in exchange for the soldier. The NATO-led forces in Afghanistan condemned the video as an affront to the soldier's family at Christmas and said he had clearly been forced to read a prepared statement. Private Bergdahl disappeared from his base near the border with Pakistan 5 months after arriving in Afghanistan. The insurgents had also released a video of him a few weeks after he was captured. It's not clear when the latest video was made. Private Bergdahl is believed to be the first American soldier to be captured alive by Taliban militants in Afghanistan.
And that was Ambarasan Etirajan. There are reports that one of Osama bin Laden's daughters has taken refuge at the Saudi embassy in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Earlier this week, newspapers in Saudi Arabia and Britain reported that several other children of Osama bin Laden have been living in a compound in Iran since fleeing Afghanistan in 2001. With more details on that story, here's Martin Venard of our West Asia desk.
The Iranian Foreign Minister, Manoucher Mottaki, said he had been told that Iman bin Laden was currently in the Saudi embassy. He said on state-run television that he did not know how the young woman had got into Iran or into the embassy. Mr. Mottaki added that Iran wanted proof of her identity before she was allowed to leave the country.
The individual can leave Iran with proof of identification and laissez-passer. Discussions have taken place recently between the foreign ministry and the Saudi embassy. We're not certain that she is the daughter of bin Laden, but that is what the embassy has said.
Earlier this week, media reports said Iman bin Laden had gone to the embassy after evading her guards in Tehran. The report said the young woman and several other of Osama bin Laden's children and relatives had been held by the Iranian authorities for 8 years after crossing from Afghanistan. Mr. Mottaki was not asked about them by Iranian TV. Part of Osama bin Laden's family were living with him in Afghanistan before the American invasion. Earlier this year, US officials said one of Osama bin Laden's sons, Saad, who had reportedly been living in Iran, was probably killed by an American missile strike in Pakistan.
Martin Venard reporting. You're listening to World Briefing from the BBC World Service, and still to come, two more Roman Catholic bishops resign in Ireland following an independent report into the church's cover-up of child sex abuse. Today's main news, Pope Benedict is carrying out his traditional Christmas duties despite an incident in which he was assaulted by a young woman. It's 16:14 GMT.
There has been international condemnation of a decision by the Chinese authorities to sentence the country's most prominent dissident, Liu Xiaobo, to 11 years in prison on charges of incitement to subvert state power. The sentence was described as extremely harsh by the United Nations and also criticised by Gregory May, a spokesman for the US Embassy in Beijing.
The United States government is deeply concerned by the sentence of 11 years in prison announced today in the case of prominent Chinese democracy activist Liu Xiaobo under the charge of inciting subversion of state power. Persecution of individuals for the peaceful expression of political views is inconsistent with internationally recognized norms of human rights.
Liu Xiaobo, a veteran of the Tiananmen Square demonstrations 20 years ago, campaigned for political reform in China. He was detained last December. Our correspondent in Beijing, Michael Bristow, has been following the case of Liu Xiaobo.
He was accused of incitement to subvert state power. But what that meant specifically was that he'd helped draft a document called Charter 08. Now, this was a political manifesto calling for a change to the political system in China. He also authored, wrote a number of articles criticising China's one-party state. And the prosecutor cited both those examples of reason why they put him on trial. And Mr. Liu, he wasn't a major rabble-rouser. He wasn't a really inspirational figure who gathered people together and got them out onto the streets. He was a former university professor. The fact that they've decided to go after him and to put him in prison for such a long time suggests that they're fearful of basically anybody who stands out, stands up and challenges their authority.
And that was our correspondent Michael Bristow in Beijing. In Ireland, two more Roman Catholic bishops have submitted their resignations a month after an independent report detailed how child sex abuse was covered up for three decades by the Catholic Church. As Jane Wall reports, this has now led to a total of four bishops standing down.
The announcement that two more bishops were planning to step down came during Christmas Mass. A statement by the bishops Eamon Walsh and Raymond Field was read out to worshippers at church services across Dublin. In it, they said they hoped their resignation would help to bring the peace and reconciliation of Jesus Christ to the victims of child sexual abuse, though both bishops said they'd done nothing wrong. Earlier this month, two other bishops resigned after being named as negligent, following a government-led investigation which found that church leaders in Dublin spent decades shielding more than 170 paedophile priests from the law. The news has profoundly undermined the reputation of the Irish Church, once a key institution in the country. It now faces an uncertain future. Attendance at Mass has fallen dramatically in recent years, and with many priests approaching retirement, there's a chronic shortage of new, younger ministers to replace them. In his Christmas message to the church, the Archbishop of Ireland referred to the horrendous scandal of child abuse.
Jane Wall reporting. And to keep following our main news stories, if you're out and about and you have a mobile phone, all you need to do is save bbc.com/news on your phone. In the West African country of Mali, an international team restoring a mosque in the historic city of Timbuktu has uncovered traces of the original 14th century mud building. The mosque is coated with a new layer of mud each year. From Timbuktu, our correspondent Andrew Harding reports.
For 3 years now, experts have been delicately peeling away centuries of mud from the Jingwere Bear Mosque. Slowly, the original 14th century structure has emerged from beneath all those layers. Conservation expert Josephine Delario says ancient sculptured artwork has now been revealed, and under the central courtyard, traces of an even older mosque.
Now that we found this other mosque, in fact, we found other two levels of mosque, maybe we should review the real age of the mosque.
It's now hoped the mosque's restoration work will help revive old skills in a town that's still largely made up of mud and straw houses.
We hope that the community, as they already appreciate our work, they will be stimulated somehow to do that again on their home, on their houses, because, for example, the last rainy season, a lot of houses fell down in Timbuktu.
A final coat of expertly mixed, rainproof mud should be applied to the mosque towards the end of 2010.
That report from Timbuktu in northern Mali by our correspondent Andrew Harding. Today's main news, Pope Benedict is carrying out his traditional Christmas duties despite an incident in which he was assaulted by a young woman. The United States has condemned as cruel the release of a video by the Taliban showing a US soldier they captured 6 months ago in Afghanistan. A lengthy prison sentence imposed on a leading Chinese dissident has been sharply criticised by the UN, and two more Roman Catholic bishops have resigned over a child sex scandal in Ireland. I'm Frederick Dove. You're listening to World Briefing from the BBC World Service. It's 1620 GMT.
This is Martin Weber with reflections on the business news of the past year. 2009 was pretty traumatic for the world economy. In fact, global output actually fell for the first time since the 1930s depression. But it wasn't quite as tough as many had feared 12 months ago when the whole financial system was close to breaking down. The authorities' response was quick. They cut interest rates, boosted money supply, and spent more, in particular subsidising consumers who wanted to buy a new car. How economies will react when such stimulus is removed in the coming months is yet to be seen. In the United States, unemployment soared to its highest level for 26 years. One of those statistics is this man from Rhode Island, who's now been out of work for a year and a half.
It's very degrading, it's very depressing, it's very humiliating. It's terrible. It's terrible. I've never seen things as bad in my whole life. I'm 53 years of age. And I've been out of work before, and I've been out of work for a few months here and there, but never like this.
The US jobless rate is now 10%. Still not as bad as the 30s depression, when unemployment hit 25%, but a shock to Americans nonetheless. The new workshop of the world is, of course, China. There, 150 million people are migrant workers, employed in factories hundreds of miles from their home villages. Many had to return to the countryside after factories closed when export orders dried up at the start of 2009. But with the Chinese government pumping cash into the economy, the migrant workers are on the move again. We caught up with this man looking for work in a country where $10 a day is a sought-after rate.
It is really important. For family expenses, we need to send money back home from working away. And we could buy better furniture and make a comfy home. It will mean my parents can have easier lives and there will be better conditions for my kids, the next generation.
In the end, China achieved a strong 9% annual growth rate, adding to the sense that the worst of the global crisis has passed. But the question is, have world leaders got to the root causes of what went wrong? Here's President Obama at last September's summit in Pittsburgh.
We will tie executive pay to long-term performance so that sound decisions are rewarded instead of short-term greed. In short, our financial system will be far different and more secure than the one that failed so dramatically last year.
But summit declarations and changes in the real world are two different things. As the year closes, the largest banks in the UK and US have once again announced big short-term profits and big bonuses for their traders, to the outrage of the general public. After the speculative bubble of the 1920s blew up in the 1929 Wall Street crash, politicians moved fast to break up banks and ring-fence the cash of ordinary citizens from the bank's speculative trading divisions, known as investment banks. Many economists say this should happen again, but there's no sign of such a move so far. The biggest bank bailout in Britain came at the Royal Bank of Scotland, or RBS. It has $450 billion of so-called toxic assets that are so unwanted they're impossible to value. The new boss brought in to clean up RBS is Stephen Hester. We asked him why bankers still wanted to be paid so much.
I want to be clear, we really get this. We're in no misapprehension, we're in no Alice in Wonderland about people's views on bankers' pay. We are leading the world in how we pay our people, in removing the cash bonuses, in putting in deferral and clawback and so on. But it does nobody any good if good people don't want to work for RBS.
But shouldn't banks now be broken up into the bits that hold ordinary savings and riskier investment banks?
I think it's wrong to get philosophically hung up on shape of banks. What we know is that the majority of banks that have failed have been narrow banks. either narrow investment banks or narrow mortgage banks or narrow consumer finance banks. So I'm afraid the evidence simply is not there for saying it was the shape of banks that was the problem. And the evidence, in fact, is that narrow banks have tended to be riskier than more broadly based banks.
Stephen Hester with a robust defence of conglomerate banks. But one man who thinks the status quo has to change is the respected London economist Roger Bootle. He thinks conglomerate banks should be broken up. But what of Stephen Hester's argument that the universal banks, that had lots of different types of operations, actually did better during the crisis than the narrow banks?
I don't know how you can argue that universal banks did better. When we had RBS as a universal bank, it did pretty badly, it seems to me. Maybe there's someone around that RBS did better than that other person, I don't know, but I don't know quite who on earth they are. All sorts of banks did badly in this kerfuffle. I don't think that's frankly the issue. The issue is about getting clarity about which institutions the taxpayer should support, because we can't have a system in the future under which banks can do whatever they like, pay themselves whatever they like. Oh, and by the way, when they get into trouble, let's have the taxpayer bail them out. That simply won't wash.
But in the meantime, you've got RBS still trying to build up an investment banking division where 4,000 or 5,000 traders are taking speculative positions in financial markets.
Now, I don't understand why RBS is doing that, I have to say. I don't understand why the government's allowing them to do it either. It seems to me that their priority ought to be to get out of such areas and to concentrate their firepower on providing finance for British business and British households.
But isn't the problem there's not actually that much money in that, whereas in the short term, these investment banking activities, which generally involve taking on risk, being paid for it, are earning them a lot more money?
Well, there's a paradox about investment banking, because when it's profitable, it's very, very profitable. We don't actually know whether, over the long run, actually it's profitable at all. If you totted up the money made over the years against various bailouts, whether investment banks actually make any money at all.
So these big banks like Goldman Sachs, do they really generate wealth for an economy?
Goldman Sachs is the most successful investment bank by far. There is, though, I think, a legitimate question about quite how far its own success translates into benefits for the economy overall. If it's a merger and acquisition, the evidence is pretty clear on all this, that actually, on average, this activity adds nothing at all to human welfare. Actually, it destroys value. It's all about the ego and the rewards of the chief executives concerned. Now, when they're commissioning an investment bank to work with them, are they interested in the costs of this to the shareholder? No, they're not. If the real owners of the business, that's to say people like you and me, through our pension funds and our insurance policies, if we were actually choosing to spend all this dosh on hiring Goldman Sachs or whoever to undertake an M&A deal, I suspect actually that we wouldn't be that keen. So to tackle this problem, I think you have to get right to the root of this distinction between ownership and management. It's a profound crisis of the capitalist structure that's brought us to this position.
Do you remain optimistic that capitalism can be reformed?
I'm a great fan of capitalism. I don't think the alternative is actually very attractive at all. It is, though, all about actually the type of capitalism. I think this problem has been there with us in a sort of unrevealed form for quite a few years, actually, the last 30 or 40 or 50 years. It hasn't always been there, by the way. If you go back to the 19th century, 19th century capitalism, businesses on the whole were controlled by the people who owned them. And a lot of this problem, I think, comes down to the idea of regarding the ownership of a firm as so many gambling chips to be traded in. Now, I'm rather keen on the idea of action being taken to reduce the incentive to trade, if, for instance, there were taxes on financial transactions. I also floated the idea of restricting eligibility to dividends to people who've held the shares for quite a substantial minimum period. I've actually said in my book as much as 2 years. But the idea is to actually put an incentive in the system for people to regard themselves as long-term holders. So actually, if they traded the shares in and out before then, they wouldn't actually get any dividends.
Roger Bootle, author of a new book called The Trouble with Markets, setting out for us how he thinks the flaws of capitalism can be repaired. And that's it from this review of World Business News.
The BBC World Service in the United States is distributed by Public Radio International. Distribution is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. More information online at gatesfoundation.org, and by individual donors to PRI, whose contributions help bring innovation and diversity to public radio programming.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home, located at the corner of Elman University in the historic Trivette Mansion across from Westside Park in downtown Champaign. Owens Funeral Home, owned and operated by the Owens family since 1925, invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
BBC, BBC.
You're with the BBC. Today's Outlook is a special programme about the unlikely friendship between a working mum in London and an Iraqi academic in Baghdad. For 4 years, Mae Whitwit and B. Rowlett kept in touch by email as the security situation in the Iraqi capital deteriorated. When Mae decided she needed to escape, she turned to B. for help. They'll tell their story on Outlook after the news.
BBC News with David Austin. Pope Benedict has delivered his traditional Christmas Day message in Rome, hours after being knocked to the ground by a woman at the start of Mass. He wasn't hurt in the melee on Thursday night. The Vatican says the woman who leapt at the Pope is now undergoing psychiatric assessment. Queen Elizabeth, in her Christmas message, has expressed sadness at the number of British soldiers killed while fighting in Afghanistan. 106 have died there this year, the highest annual total since the Falklands conflict in 1982. The United States has condemned a video released by the Taliban of an American soldier they captured in Afghanistan in June. The soldier identifies himself as Private Beau Robert Bergdahl. He criticizes the United States over the war in Afghanistan and American relations with Muslims. The United Nations has condemned a decision by the judicial authorities in China to jail the leading dissident Liu Xiaobo for 11 years on charges of subversion. Mr. Liu helped draft a manifesto calling for political change in China. Two more Roman Catholic bishops in Ireland have submitted their resignations in the aftermath of an investigation into child sex abuse by priests, bringing the total to four. A report showed that church leaders concealed sexual attacks on children by large numbers of priests for more than three decades. Senior officials from the Palestinian movement Hamas are due in Cairo and Damascus to discuss Israel's offer of a deal to obtain the release of the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. Hamas controls Gaza, which is where Mr. Shalit has been held by Palestinian militants since being taken captive in 2006. Iran says it's been told by Saudi Arabian diplomats that a daughter of the Al-Qaeda leader, Osama bin Laden, is staying at the Saudi embassy in Tehran. It follows reports that several of Osama bin Laden's children have been living in a compound in Iran since fleeing Afghanistan in 2001. And that's the latest BBC News.
Hello and welcome to Outlook from the BBC World Service. I'm Matthew Bannister. Today, a special programme.
A massive American-led assault on the regime of Saddam Hussein is now underway. Cruise missiles were fired overnight at Baghdad. Within the past couple of hours, it's become clear that American troops are on the move towards Iraq.
The night sky is just lighting up with flashes ahead of us. This is the shock and awe that has been talked about in recent weeks, and it now has begun.
The US-led invasion of Iraq began on the 20th of March 2003. Just a few weeks later, images of Iraqis rejoicing as the country's dictator Saddam Hussein lost his grip on power were beamed around the world.
Thank you so much to Mr. President George Bush and Mr. Tony Blair, because they have liberated us from Saddam Hussein and his gang and his regime.
But in the years that followed, these celebrations turned to fear and misery for many Iraqis as the country descended into turmoil caused by the growing insurgent movement and fighting between different religious factions.
Amidst this violence and instability, an unlikely friendship developed, which crossed borders, cultures and traditions, between May Witwit, an Iraqi academic living in the heart of Baghdad, and B. Rolat, a World Service journalist living in a safe, leafy part of London. They corresponded through email for almost 4 years. This exchange ended up having a life-changing effect and has now been turned into the forthcoming book Talking About Jane Austen in Baghdad. Throughout this programme, we'll be hearing May and Bee's extraordinary story through some of those emails, and they'll be joining me in the studio.
We have asked the Iraqi police and the National Guard to secure all our polling centres.
I am optimistic about the advance of freedom, and so should the American people. We're witnessing amazing history.
2 days to go till the elections in Iraq and another day of killing. 11 dead in...
17th of January, 2005. Dear May, thank you for agreeing to be available for interview. I've been phoning around all week trying to make contact with various English-speaking Iraqis to interview in the run-up to the elections at the end of this month, so I was very happy to find you.
Hi, B. I received your email and was delighted. It has been ages since I've been in contact with anyone from Britain. Life here is a mini hell. As you know, I teach English literature at Baghdad University. I think it helps my students because the world of Jane Austen is so far removed from our daily terror of bombs and violence.
The long process of counting the 8.5 million votes cast in last month's election in Iraq has come to an end. Almost half of them went to a coalition of Shiite Muslim candidates backed by Iraq's most senior cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani.
22nd of June 2005. Hello, May. How are you? I hope you're well. It seems like such a long time since the elections, and looking at the news over here, nothing seems to be getting any better. The BBC is reporting a study that puts the civilian death toll since the invasion at around 25,000 people. So shocking. It's been a busy time here, but I'm having a good summer. We have a heat wave here in the UK, and London looks so beautiful. It's shimmering.
Bee's world of juggling her career and three children in London couldn't have been more different from May's life in Baghdad. But these emails became May's escape into a life where freedom and security were taken for granted and simple pleasures could be enjoyed without having to worry about dodging explosions and militia and not having enough fuel. What was it like to get emails from B when things were very unstable around you in Baghdad?
I always said to her in my emails that it was like an ice cream in the desert because it was so unstable. Everything was in a chaos. And she gave me the feeling of something settled, a normality.
And was there anyone else with you in Baghdad who you were able to speak to about what was happening?
At the beginning, I was on my own. And then it was my husband afterwards. And we sort of talked to each other and we sort of comforted each other about the situation, but it was beyond our control. We needed a voice from outside to tell us that we are still alive and we are still sane.
As the security situation deteriorated and life became more difficult for May, she wrote to Bee about her growing desire to leave Iraq.
26th of July, 2006. I received your email and was really happy to see you having a nice time. It gives me some hope for a better world. Do you know, B, that I am 46 years old and still can't do what I want? What is worse now is the threat of losing our lives just because we are university teachers. Some of my colleagues have been viciously murdered and others have received threats warning them that if they don't leave the country, they will meet a similar fate. B, although we have only known each other via email, I feel that you understand me. I know that I'm probably asking too much, but can you please inquire whether I can get asylum or anything similar?
Dear May, I'm going to try. I'll contact some friends I have who work at the Refugee Council. That's a charity which helps asylum seekers and refugees. To find out what the best procedure is, I know it's not easy, but I will look into it and let you know. Hang in there, May.
But the chances of May being granted asylum in the UK looked slim at best. Between the US-led invasion and the end of 2006, almost 6,000 Iraqis applied to come to Britain, and the government started to clamp down on new applicants.
25th of November 2006. I don't know what to tell you. My country is flooded by bloodbath. Death is everywhere, and it was right in front of me on Thursday as we almost got killed by those who call themselves a police force but are actually militias. I can't describe the situation, but it was like the gates of hell have been flung open. We have been under curfew for the past 3 days, and despite that, people are getting massacred and even burned alive, B. I'm scared and don't know what to do.
B, what was it like to get these emails from May as the security situation got worse? You must have been incredibly disturbed.
Yes, definitely. It was an extremely stressful time. Indeed, our relationship went very quickly from curiosity, because at the outset, it was fascinating to speak to someone who could just talk in a natural way about very unnatural things, as far as I'm concerned, living in a war zone. So it went very quickly from curiosity to a kind of compulsion, feeling just dread every time I looked at the headlines and just being constantly worried about her, and it always seemed to be getting worse.
And did you feel helpless and powerless in the situation?
Yes, I mean, I knew my emails cheered her up. So quite often I'd sort of try and say, oh, you know, I baked a really great cake. You know, the kids are doing fine. But her email would have said, you know, my colleague's been beheaded. So, you know, at times I just felt ridiculous as well as helpless. And so, yes, very intense emotions in all directions, really.
27th of December 2006. We are physically okay, but our area has been occupied by the Islamic extremists. We don't know what to do. Ali was out buying cigarettes and bread when a stranger shouted at him that smoking was sinful and that he had to put his cigarette out. Then this person shouted in a loud voice that any woman seen without a head cover or with makeup on would be beheaded. Of course, this applies to me, but I will not bow to this bullying. News reports say that Saddam Hussein has been handed over to the Iraqi authorities. This doesn't sound good, but we'll have to wait and see. Watching TV and waiting is all we do now, since we can't even go outside.
May, now I'm even more worried about you. I hate the extremists. I hate them. I don't want them near you. I've been glued to the news and I can't believe what I'm seeing. Please just send me a few short lines to tell me you're still there.
It's 8 o'clock on Saturday, the 30th of December. The headlines. Saddam Hussein has been hanged.
The turbulent, hugely controversial life of Saddam Hussein was brought to an end at dawn, just as the call to prayer was sounding across Baghdad.
May, do you remember how you felt when Saddam Hussein was executed?
Well, let me tell you about it before he was executed, the night before. It was abnormal. The helicopters kept flying at low altitude, and we just felt there was something going on. We didn't know what. We had heard that he was handed to the Iraqi authorities, but we didn't know what was going to happen. And it coincided that my husband could not sleep that night, and he said that they were flying all night and even at dawn. And when I woke up around six, he said, May, I think he was executed. And
am I right in thinking you once met Saddam Hussein?
Yes, that was ages ago. I was only 18 at the time. At that time, he was very popular. Everybody loved him. And he had a direct hotline. You can just phone him. And if you have a problem, you just tell it to him. And he will either solve it immediately or tell you to come in for an interview. And I phoned, and I got the interview.
What was your problem?
Well, it was educational, actually. I wanted to transfer from the College of Science to the College of Arts. And at that time, if you had mainly scientific subjects, you were not allowed to go to arts colleges. And it was only in his hands. So I thought if I met him, he might, you know, sort of give me an exemption or something. Well, and it didn't happen.
What impression did he make on you when you sat down with him face to face?
Well, I was scared. But it was really not him as much as his bodyguards that scared us at the beginning. Don't talk to him more than 3 minutes. Don't shake hands with him. Don't attempt to kiss him. So at that time, I was really scared. So the next time I met him after 2 years, I had a Valium before I went, and it went on fine.
Allah! Allah!
This is Outlook from the BBC World Service. I'm Matthew Bannister, and in a special edition of the programme, we're hearing the emails between Bea Rowlett, a World Service journalist based in London, and Mae Whitwit, an Iraqi academic in Baghdad. The period between March 2006 and March 2007 is described as the bloodiest in Iraq since the invasion. The Iraq body count, which records civilian casualties, counted in the region of 30,000 civilian deaths in that year. Despite the dangers, May was determined to drive the 7 kilometres across Baghdad to teach her female students.
6th of March 2007. Dearest friend B, today was the worst of all. At college, I went to the hall to give my lecture, which is situated above the students' cafeteria. I walked in, greeted the students, and started talking right away. Then I heard screams downstairs and the sound of breaking glass, but I continued. As I finished, I was told that a sniper's bullet had gone through the glass of the cafeteria. I realized that the bullet could easily have penetrated a meter or two higher and hit me or one of the girls. When I finished my second lecture, I collected my stuff and went to the car park and drove out of the college. I drove for a while, then there was shooting and explosion, and everything went crazy. I closed the car windows and listened to a song, trying to fool myself that there was actually nothing to fear. I saw things that I can't describe. I finally entered our area. It was peaceful. I didn't see anything but armored cars here and there. And as I passed the last one, they shot at me. I am sure of it because I was the only car in the street. But they missed, and I'm alive.
May's and B's emails started to talk more and more about how they could get May and her husband out of Baghdad. After a few setbacks, a ray of hope appeared in the form of the Council for Assisting Refugee Academics, an organisation which helps academics who are being persecuted in the country where they live. The organisation says that 300 academics have been murdered in Iraq since the US-led invasion. What were the logistics of getting May and Ali out of the country and over here? What sort of hoops did they have to go through?
Well, first off, they had to get out of Iraq because you weren't allowed to make the application because there was no British diplomatic representative in Iraq. So they had to get over the border in order to even try to get the fellowship application. So that was one obstacle. Then they had to have financial backing, they had to have letters of invitation and a place at a university here in the UK that would offer some, you know, to waive the fees.
May and Ali managed to get out of Baghdad and travelled to Damascus to apply for their UK visa. Although they were safe, the psychological impact of what they'd been through started to take its toll.
4th of September 2007. Hello, my bunny wee sister. We live in an area that is overpopulated with Iraqis. Syrians are a minority here. It is inhabited by the Iraqi ex-middle class. To be honest, B, I am safe but not very happy. I miss my life. I even miss the streets and the destroyed city. It is my home. I miss my bed, my books, my china. Oh, B, I even miss the bombs. I feel so lonely and so out of touch. But I guess this is what war is all about. Tell me, how are the lovely girls? News of them keep me going.
My dear May, I'm so sorry you're missing home. I thought so. Oh, it's so sad. I don't know what to say. So, here is some news. I hope it helps. Elsa is really lovely now, May. People just love her when they see her, and I think she's the happiest baby I've ever met. Eve was really happy at school and bursting with energy. Zola's a bit tired at the moment. Sometimes after school she runs upstairs and hides in her room saying she wants some peace and quiet.
But as things started to develop and you grew closer to May and to the difficulties and the problems that she was facing, did you feel daunted by what you were doing in trying to get her and Ali into the UK?
Yes, a lot. I mean, there's times actually now that I'm not particularly proud of where I just really thought I absolutely can't cope with this. There was one occasion where I was up to my neck in children and I was really stressed about work. And I got a text from May as I was trying to cook dinner and scream at the kids saying, why haven't you replied to my email? And I just thought, I can't do this. I can't do this.
Delays in the visa process and the high cost of living in Damascus made it impossible for May and Ali to continue staying there. So after 7 months, they went back to Baghdad.
2nd of January 2008. Dearest friend, Happy New Year. I did not write to you in the past few days because I did not want to spoil your Christmas and the fun. The problem is that I've been told that my name is on the list of those to be assassinated. If anything happens to me, please don't stop your efforts to get Ali out of the country.
Aside from the paperwork, one of the main obstacles to getting May and Ali out of Iraq was money. The amount that was needed, about £30,000, was way beyond anything that B could afford. Then a solution presented itself.
The ray of light that broke through those very stormy skies at that moment was a book deal from Penguin, and they very generously offered us an advance of £10,000. So that sort of went in the bank, and we had to think, how do we get the rest? Because we needed the money up front before she could even leave the country. In the end, it took so long and it was just getting worse and worse. And in the end, I borrowed the remaining sum from my extended family. So that's how we rustled the rest up.
So, B, by helping May financially and getting the book deal and supporting her in this way, did you feel in any way that it was compromising your impartiality as a journalist?
Well, I met May as a journalist. And then as soon as we became friends, I think I ceased to be a journalist. So it hasn't been a journalistic endeavour at any point since we met, you know. And the fact that it became a book is only the very last piece of the jigsaw. That came very, very late towards the end in the last sort of frantic efforts to get her out.
1st of February 2008. Dizzy is inadequate to describe how I feel. Delirious? No. Dreamy? No. I think I'm going crazy. Do you think that I will one day put my feet up and sleep the whole night without being awakened by the sound of explosions and bullets? Will I bid farewell to the sight of blood, chaos and damage? Farewell to those ignorant, uneducated traditionalists who wander around trying to get their revenge from anyone who is even slightly well-off or educated? Will I be able to take a shower whenever I want and dry my hair when I choose without having to put the generator on and then turn it off to save on fuel? Will I be able to go out for a walk and breathe fresh air? All I want from life is to be able to live and talk freely without any fear.
Instead of going back to Damascus, this time May and Ali planned to get visas for neighbouring Jordan so they could apply for their British visas there. But as they'd already learned, every small step they took unearthed a new challenge.
7th August 2008. OB, what can I say? The visa papers have arrived from Jordan. They have been here since the 4th and no one bothered to tell us. Anyway, I went and got them, only to find out that they have written Ali's second name wrong, which means the papers have to go back to Jordan for correction. The man at the document delivery company warned me that it would take at least a month to go and come back. I nearly collapsed. The taxi was waiting for me outside, and I was weeping behind my sunglasses. Imagine, B, after all that waiting and suffering, we have been met by this stupid obstacle.
Oh, May, what else can go wrong? It's just unbelievable. I'm so sorry for you both. It's as though a new and unexpected obstacle manages to meet us at every single stage of the process. I can quite see how you and Ali must feel somehow cursed. But, May, I've always thought that a big load of bad luck means that the same amount of good luck is on its way. And so it must mean that you and Ali are due some really wonderful luck.
Although this delayed everything once more, May did get to Jordan, reluctantly leaving Ali behind. After a nail-biting time, May managed to persuade the Jordanian Ministry of the Interior to correct the spelling mistake on her husband's documents, and they were reunited.
17th of October, 2008. Dearest B, we did it. Yes, we did it. I can't describe how Ali and I feel. They wouldn't let us both in, so I went in alone. The man handed me the two envelopes. I opened the first envelope, and there was my passport. it involuntarily opened at a page with a stamp that had my photo and the words entry clearance. Then I had to sit down and open Ali's envelope. I just couldn't believe my eyes. I played my last trick on him. I changed my face to look sad and turned to face him. He tried hard to ask, and when he managed at last to say, "May, what are the results?" I burst out laughing and shouted, "Congratulations, we made it."
Can't believe you tricked Ali like that. Poor thing. It's unbelievable, isn't it, May? Well, I've been imagining these words for so long, May, and now at last I can say them. See you at the airport on Sunday.
What was it like when you saw May coming through from the plane?
I recognised her immediately. Because we'd sort of been a bit nervous about, oh, you know, what are you going to look like? Are you going to try and be really smart and elegant? And we both sort of, you know, oh, let's not bother, let's just be ourselves. And unfortunately, she'd had a rather horrible encounter being detained for a long time by immigration. So I was there with the kids and a huge sign that they'd done in Arabic saying, "Ehlen Biki for London," is that right?
Yes.
Welcome to London. And she didn't come through for 3 hours.
What was happening to you, May, in there?
They thought that I was smuggling drugs.
Because you look like such a drug dealer.
Because, you know, I brought my medicines. I take a lot of medicines, and I brought a year's supply.
Welcome to Britain, eh?
Thank you. that's a
terrible way to arrive, but presumably getting through that, you were then excited to see B and the children.
I just wanted to go out. The phone didn't work, and I just wanted to tell them that we are here. Don't worry, we'll be either kicked back home or let in, but don't worry. And, well, when I went out, they were so tired of waiting.
What did you do? Did you give each other a hug?
Yes, yes.
Were there a few tears?
Yeah, well, I think so, a little bit, yes.
Because that must have been an extraordinary moment after all the correspondence, all the things you'd been through.
It was a dream. You know, that moment was something I'll never forget all my life. It was something like a family reunion. Because I loved B so much, I still do, and her children were so important to me. I just wanted, you know, to hug them and sort of take a smell them as well, and that's what happened.
And you've been living here now for a year. How has life been? Has it been difficult for you?
Well, it's difficult if you talk about working hard at this age, yes, but still, I have hope now. I mean, back home, I didn't have any hope. Now I have hope. Maybe someday things will get better. Maybe I'll get a better job if I get my PhD finished. So there is hope. And there's always B to my side. She's helping me all the time.
B, has your friendship changed since it's not over the ether and it's in real person, face to face?
Yes, yes. It's much improved. Because it's on a more equal footing, you know? I don't feel like I have to always cheer May up, which was a bit burdensome at times. You know, it's wonderful. We just enjoy each other. May's just really cheeky and naughty and we just have a brilliant laugh together and see each other as much as we can.
Yes.
And what about the children? Were you pleased to see them?
Oh, I love them. I love them. I really do. They are my nieces. That's what I call them. And they are really my nieces.
And are you still in touch with friends and family back in Baghdad?
Well, probably just my mother. I'm in touch with her. Some of my colleagues, but not much. We don't exchange much information.
Do you think about Baghdad a lot? Do you feel homesick for it? Do you feel concerned for it?
I feel concerned. But not homesick, no, but concerned, because it is getting worse and worse. And I don't know when things will come out and when things will be better. I don't know.
Do you ever think how different things would have been if you hadn't struck up this correspondence with B?
Well, we would have been still there, and probably I would have been, either me or Ali would have been killed. Or both of us, probably, because I was shot several times, and so was he.
And what sort of impact has it made on your life, Bea, and on the family's life, to have May and Ali in your circle of friends?
Oh, it's lovely. They call them Auntie May and Uncle Ali. You know, they're coming down for Christmas, and it's just great.
The long-distance friendship of Bea Rowlatt and Mae Whitwit. Their full email correspondence will be published in a new book called Talking About Jane Austen in Baghdad early in the new year. There are more details on our website at bbcworldservice.com/outlook.
Join us Christmas Day at 12:04 p.m. for Professor Paul Landis' reading of A Christmas Carol. For years, the live reading at the auditorium was a traditional part of the pre-holiday scene for students and faculty at the university. The tradition lives on at AM 580, where we broadcast this recording every year. Sit back and enjoy Professor Landis' reading of A Christmas Carol, Friday afternoon at 12:04, following NPR News.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It is part of what makes a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.